Welcome back to the program. Today it's my great privilege to be joined by a retired four-star general, Harald Kujat, who was the head of the German Armed Forces, the Bundeswehr, as the largest, or sorry, as the highest ranking position in the German Armed Forces. He also served as well served on NATO's military committee, which is also the highest military position within NATO. So welcome to the program. It's a great privilege to have you on.
My pleasure.
So I wanted to ask first about the state of relations between the West and Russia, because well, after the Cold War, there was great optimism about the relations between the West and Russia. Yet now we're stuck in this proxy war in Ukraine, which can escalate to an actual nuclear war. How do you see the relations between Russia and the West going so bad over the past 30 years?
Ja, es ist richtig, dass im Grunde die
It
Beziehungen
is true that
nach dem
fundamentally,
Kalten Krieg
relations
zwischen
after the
Russland und
Cold
der
War,
Sowjetunion
and actually
waren
even before the
sehr
dissolution of the Soviet
Russland
Union,
damals noch sehr
between NATO
stabil
and Russia,
und
and at
verbessert
that
worden
time
ist,
still the Soviet
Modernisierung
Union,
und verbessert
improved.
worden.
Great
Und
efforts were made, and in 1990, for example, there was already supposed to be a mutual exchange, a dialogue, and even a strategic partnership established between NATO and Russia. Russia actually sought closer ties with NATO, and then in 1991, with what was essentially the first strategic concept in NATO's history, a real new beginning was made.
ist ein wirklicher Neuanfang gemacht worden und das setzte sich dann fort natürlich über den
And this
NATO-Russland
continued, of course, with the NATO-Russia Founding Act, the establishment of the NATO-Russia Council, both on the political level, from ambassadors to defense and foreign ministers up to heads of state and government, and on the military side, of course, the chiefs of general staff, who met at least twice a year. A permanent Russian military representative was also present at headquarters with a small staff, and these meetings then took place at least once a month.
Diese Meetings haben dann zumindest einmal im Monat stattgefunden. Ich selbst war ja auch Vorsitzender des NATO-Russland-Rates
I
und
myself was
Generalstab
also chairman of the NATO-Russia Council of
Generalstabsgipfel.
Chiefs of
Wir waren
Defense.
hier in dieser Mission
Incidentally,
auch
which is
Vorsitzende
often
der NATO
forgotten, in this role I was
Ukraine-Delegation
also chairman of the NATO-Ukraine Commission
und ich
of
war eine
Chiefs of Defense.
Leitende, also
So I
mit
had
einer
both
führenden
sides sitting at my negotiating table.
Position. Und
And of
das
course,
hat
that
natürlich
also opened up new perspectives.
nun, was
Now,
die
regarding the
innenpolitische
changes, it
Perspektive
must be
angeht,
said that
sagen
they
Sie,
actually
dann
began at the
eigentlich
strategic level in
die strategische Rolle zu Russland ein.
2002 with the
Nun, wir
termination of
sagen,
the
wir sind
ABM
Mitglied
Treaty by the
Abkommen
United
haben mit den
States.
Vereinigten Staaten.
A
Das ist
very
wichtig,
important
wir haben
treaty.
also
ABM
Amerika als
stands for
eine
Anti-Ballistic
Vereinigte
Missile
Allianz
Defense
zwar.
Treaty.
Das war
That was,
damals
so to speak, the
das
complement to the
Agenda
Treaty
des
on Intercontinental Strategic
der
Systems,
regierenden
meaning on the
Vereinigten
one hand
Staaten.
the
Wir haben
offensive and then
verschiedene
the defensive
Systeme, also
systems.
einmal die offensiven und dann die defensiven Systeme. Diese Ergänzung sollte für nuklearstrategische
This
Stabilität
addition was
sorgen, aus
intended
dem
to ensure
Beispiel der
nuclear
Atomwaffen.
strategic stability
Russland hat
between the
nicht
two
verstanden,
nuclear
dass
superpowers,
den
and
Versuch,
Russia understood this as an
Minas
attempt to gain
gegenüber den
dominance
Russen
and
zu gewinnen, über
superiority
diesen
in this
Moment
area.
politisch. Der
The political
Versuch
rupture then
war,
occurred in
sich zusammenzuschlagen
2008
mit
at
dem
the NATO
Westen und
summit
die
in
Verbündeten
Bukarest,
auf
where
den
then US
Atlantik
President Bush
zurückzuerobern.
tried with considerable force to
Mit der
push through an
Annahme einer
invitation for Georgia
Erneuerung
and
der
Ukraine
Allianz und
to
der
become NATO members.
NATO-Mitglieder
That did
wird.
not succeed
Das
at the
ist nicht
time.
gelungen
But in
damals.
order to save
Jetzt haben wir
face, a
hier eine
perspective was included in the
Perspektive,
communique
bei
that
der
Ukraine could
diese
eventually
Verpflichtung, die
become a
aufgenommen
NATO
wurde,
member.
Ukraine dann doch NATO-Mitglied werden könnte. Und diese beiden Ereignisse sind für mich eigentlich die
And
Wendepunkte
for me, these
in
two
der
events are
Beziehung
actually the
der beiden
turning
Russen.
points in the relationship
Ich will
between
noch
NATO
kurz
and
erklären,
Russia.
warum das so ist.
I would like to add
Russland
why
hat
that
eine der
is.
wichtigsten strategischen Ziele
Russia's two
erreicht.
most important
Erstens,
strategic
einen
goals
Konflikt mit der
are
anderen
first,
Militär- und
to avoid a
Sicherheitsallianz zu
conflict
vermeiden.
with the other nuclear superpower, the
Zweitens,
United
wichtigste
States.
strategische
The
Ziele,
second most important
Russland
strategic
einen
goal for
Konflikt
Russia
im
is
direkten
to avoid
Bedrohungsfeld
a
mit der
direct
NATO,
military
weil
conflict
aus
with
dem
NATO,
Grunde auch
which
die
basically also
Bedrohung
implies
durch
that a
eine NATO
confrontation with the
Außengrenze
United States
mit
could
Russland
occur.
zusammenkommen könnte.
These two
Diese
goals have
Ziele
always
waren
been
und sind
dominant.
immer
As
dominant,
early as the
weil Ende der
mid-1990s, Russia
90er Jahre
repeatedly articulated
ist das
this.
von Russland immer wieder artikuliert worden. Und ich kann also
And
aus
so I can
eigener
say from
Erfahrung
personal
sagen,
experience that this
dass
was
immer
always
wieder
evident
Ziele
in the
waren,
discussions we
immer wieder
had.
deutlich, immer wieder
Ultimately,
deutlich.
this
Sie
objective
hatten
led
diese
Russia to
Beziehung
try,
dazu geführt,
during the
dass
negotiations on the
Russland
NATO-Russia
sich
Founding Act in
angenähert hat an die
1997, to push for co-decision making, that is, joint decisions on security risks for Russia or for NATO. Of course, that was not possible, because decisions of this kind can only be made by the member states. But we found a formulation that ultimately did establish a mechanism for crisis and conflict management, including the possibility, in certain situations and under certain conditions, to make decisions jointly.
Bedingungen gemeinsam zu entscheiden. Das ist der entscheidende Punkt. Und diese
That is the crucial point. And this buffer zone, in which Russia assumed that in this buffer zone, that is, in the former Warsaw Pact states, including Ukraine, crisis conflicts could arise that could then lead to a direct military confrontation between NATO and Russia. That was the major concern. That is why a buffer zone was supposed to be established here, to prevent this. After NATO expansion, the focus naturally shifted to Ukraine. So in this war that is being waged here, Russia is trying to achieve exactly this goal, which they have been pursuing for decades.
Well, when the Russians invaded in 2022, we embraced this narrative that it was unprovoked. This is quite an important narrative, because once we accepted that this narrative that the Russian invasion was unprovoked, it meant that any negotiations was seen as rewarding aggression and conquest. So the only path to peace was military victory, that is, defeating Russia. Do you agree with this assessment of the provocations and the Russian motivations?
There are two arguments that are repeatedly mentioned. You named one of them. The war was unprovoked. The second is that it was supposed to be an all-encompassing war. That means Russia's goal is to conquer all of Ukraine. I want to address both aspects. Unprovoked. That's a question that can actually be answered relatively quickly, but I do want to elaborate a bit. This war has a long history, and Jeffrey Sachs recently spoke and wrote in great detail about this background, providing thorough reasoning. That's why I don't want to go into detail about it here. But one of the crucial points is the coup against the democratically elected Ukrainian President Yanukovych in 2014, followed by a civil war in eastern Ukraine, which was mainly fought between the Ukrainian army and the Russian-speaking population there. This had a lot to do with the fact that the rights, the civil rights of this Russian-speaking population were severely restricted. Then came Minsk II in 2015. And in this agreement, an attempt was made to find a solution to resolve this conflict. The core of this agreement is that these Donbass regions were granted a special status within the Ukrainian state, meaning they were allowed to speak Russian, practice Russian culture, and so on, and that this was to be codified in a constitutional amendment by the end of 2015.
Das ist von der ukrainischen Regierung nicht erfolgt.
That was not done by the Ukrainian government. In fact, something entirely different happened. They began to modernize the Ukrainian armed forces, to rearm them, to increase their size again. We had significantly reduced them at the beginning of the century, and now they were being expanded again. As we all later heard from Ms. Merkel, who helped negotiate this agreement, and also from the then French President Hollande, the real intention was not to resolve this conflict, but rather to buy time in order to rearm the Ukrainian armed forces. That must be described as a clear act of deception. So I'll jump ahead to the year 2021. In December 2021, Russia then attempted to defuse this security situation through agreements on security arrangements, both directly with the United States and with NATO. Both sides rejected negotiations on this. At the same time, Russia tried to exert pressure by massing a large number of troops on Ukraine's borders. In other words, they were actually trying to create negotiating pressure. Russia did not succeed in this. On the contrary, the situation significantly worsened over the course of January and February 2022, and Russia then invaded. And now comes a crucial point. The question is always, what strategic goal am I pursuing with this? So, what was Russia's intention with this? And up to today, there have really only been two realistic opinions. One was that they wanted to increase pressure, not just outside Ukraine's borders anymore, but by occupying parts of Ukraine and thereby forcing Ukraine to negotiate. I had a different view. My opinion was that Russia wanted to try to overthrow the Ukrainian government. In other words, to bring about a regime change, as it's called today, and install a pro-Russian government. That would have essentially avoided a war. Why do I believe this was their intention? For one thing, because the entire conduct of operations didn't allow for anything else. Around 170,000 Russian soldiers have effectively marched in, not in attack formations, but rather they have entered as an occupying force, so to speak, against a Ukrainian army of more than 400,000 troops, modernly equipped, as mentioned, modernized and trained by the West for 8 years. This means that occupying the entire country is not possible, neither in terms of the number of soldiers required for such an occupation, nor in terms of being victorious against the Ukrainian defenses. Secondly, strategic points were occupied, which were intended to ensure that a regime change could actually be carried out. That did not succeed. Incidentally, some time ago, Ukrainian President Zelensky confirmed exactly this in side discussions in Davos. He was supposed to be replaced by Medvedchuk, that is the former opposition leader in the Verkhovna Rada, who was supposed to become president and is considered pro-Russian. So this assessment or narrative that Russia supposedly carried out an unprovoked attack is not tenable. And the other claim, that Russia tried, or is still trying, as is sometimes asserted, to occupy the entire Ukraine, that is also not tenable. Russia's objectives have changed by now. The regime change did not succeed. Now Russia's goal is to occupy the four regions, Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, within their former administrative borders. And even here, there are nuances that are very important, because the two self-proclaimed People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk have a completely different status. In essence, a secession has taken place here, even though Russia then, on September 30, 2022, effectively incorporated these regions into the Russian state.
Now, you have mentioned and criticized the undermining of the Minsk agreement between 2015 and 22. Yeah. But you also made the point that this was this undermined international law itself, given that it was approved by the United Nations. However, I also want to ask you, though, about the Istanbul negotiations as they came in the beginning of 2022. Given that in March of 2022, President Zelensky, he gave an interview to The Economist, and he warned that there were some Western countries who would prefer a long war with Russia to weaken Russia, even if this would mean the destruction of Ukraine. I was wondering, though, about the Istanbul negotiations. What do we actually know now about the sabotage of this agreement?
There were two negotiation approaches, initially in Belarus, 4 days after the start of the Russian attack, and then the negotiations in Istanbul, which you mentioned. In these negotiations in Istanbul, both sides, as is always the case in such situations, negotiated from a position where they saw the talks as the only sensible way out. Russia did so because the attempt I just described to bring about a regime change had failed. And Ukraine, because it assumed that Russia would indeed wage a massive war here, which Ukraine would not survive.
Die Ukraine nicht überstehen würde. Das führte auch zu
This also led to a willingness to compromise on both sides. Ultimately, this round of negotiations ended on April 15th with an agreement on Ukraine's permanent neutrality and security guarantees. This is very important because the issue of security guarantees continues to play a major role today. The treaty was largely negotiated. There were still points in it that had not been clearly resolved. One important unresolved issue was how the guarantor powers would exercise their guarantee obligations. The contract included a clause about security guarantees for Ukraine. The guarantor powers were supposed to be the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, including Russia. Russia insisted that before any guarantee case could arise, there should be a vote among the guarantor powers, which Ukraine interpreted as a way to block the fulfillment of the guarantee obligation with a veto. But there were also other issues, for example, regarding the overall size of the Ukrainian armed forces. There were differing opinions on that as well.
Da gab es unterschiedliche Auffassungen. Es wurden ja auch festgelegt, die Zahl der Großwaffensysteme und vieles
mehr. The number of major weapon systems and much more was also specified. A very detailed agreement. What's crucial is that essentially it was ready to be finalized except for a few points. And these contentious issues I just mentioned were supposed to be resolved in a direct conversation between the two presidents, that is, Zelensky and Putin. This agreement, or rather its conclusion, was clearly torpedoed by the West. I think there's really no doubt about that anymore.
Gar keine Zweifel inzwischen mehr. Entscheidend war offensichtlich der unangekündigte.
The decisive factor was obviously the unannounced visit of then British Prime Minister Johnson to Kiev on April 9th, during which he made it very clear that the West was not prepared to end the war. And the Ukrainian negotiator, David Arakamiya, who led the negotiations in Istanbul, he is, so to speak, the opposition leader, the parliamentary group leader of the Zelensky party, who then returned to Kiev in the meantime, was told by Johnson, at least according to what he said in an interview, "You should not negotiate, just keep fighting." And the goal associated with this was then formulated very precisely a little later by the then American Secretary of Defense.
Amerikanischen Verteidigungsminister formuliert worden. Russland sollte politisch, wirtschaftlich und militärisch.
Russia was supposed to be weakened politically, economically, and militarily. That was the decisive point. And the means to achieve this was precisely this war. In fact, it is still this war, which is a proxy war between the United States and Russia. Now, in the meantime, President Trump has said, "It's not my war, it's Biden's war." So he no longer takes responsibility for leading this war. In the meantime, this responsibility is shifting to the Europeans. So it is becoming more and more a proxy war between Europe and Russia.
Yeah, I remember also the former Prime Minister of Israel, Bennett, was saying the same thing, that the Americans and British saw an opportunity, that is, have an army of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians which they could use against Russia. So it was almost foolish not to use them as a proxy and instead accept peace. But I thought you gave an interview back in January of 2023, which I thought was interesting, because you were then indicating that the war had already been lost and Germany could end up facing a very angry Russia by itself. Now, again, this is 2.5 years ago. At that time, everyone was chanting that Ukraine is winning and NATO has never been stronger. How did you see the developments back then that NATO was heading towards a defeat in this proxy war? And also, how do you see the relationship between Germany and the United States in this context? Do you think Germany is being subordinated now?
Well, I wasn't the only one who came to this conclusion. In the West, we kept nurturing the illusion, and thus also influenced the stance of the Ukrainian government, that Ukraine could still win this war, win it militarily. According to the official goals of the Ukrainians, that would mean recapturing Crimea, and also retaking the territories in eastern Ukraine that are now occupied by Russia. That was, and still is, a complete illusion. Anyone who understands a bit about strategy, anyone with experience in these matters, reached a different conclusion very early on, and I wasn't the only one.
Zu einem anderen Urteil, und ich war auch nicht der Einzige dabei. Also ich erinnere hier an den damaligen.
I would like to remind you of the then U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, who said that the Ukrainian armed forces have achieved what they can reasonably achieve. There's nothing more to be done, and now negotiations must take place. Of course, this also meant that he didn't remain in office much longer, but he said this very openly. Incidentally, the then Ukrainian commander-in-chief, General Zaluzhny, also said that if he were really to conduct a successful offensive, he would need, I believe he said, 300 tanks, 600 to 700 infantry fighting vehicles, and 500 howitzers. But he's not getting that.
Das bekomme ich aber nicht. Das heißt, ich kann das, was mir als politisches Ziel vorgegeben ist.
That means I can't achieve the political goal set for me at all. But in the West, the illusion was repeatedly maintained with every new weapon system, and the quality and range of the weapon systems were increased each time. And every time, it was supposed to be a game changer. In other words, it was supposed to turn the strategic situation in Ukraine's favor. That was completely hopeless from the very beginning. That also means, looking back now, what happened with this Western attitude? Our motto was, Ukraine must not lose the war, and Russia must not win the war. What nonsense it is when politicians say things like that.
When politikers so etwas sagen, aber wenn man rückblickt, muss man ja auch sagen, die Chancen, die.
But looking back, one also has to say that the opportunities that arose during the course of this war, to end the killing, to end this war, to stop the destruction of this country, were all missed. Of course, the Istanbul negotiations are particularly noteworthy in this context, but there were repeated opportunities. China then made a proposal that was very reasonable and was even accepted by Putin for a time, namely, that negotiations should resume where they left off in mid-April 2022. That means some progress toward peace would have already been made. China then, together with Brazil, proposed a six-point plan.
China hat dann gemeinsam mit Brasilien ein Sechs-Punkte-Plan vorgeschlagen. Ich selbst habe ja dann 2023
im. I myself, together with Peter Brandt and Horst Telchik, made proposals in August 2023. Of course, these have since been overtaken by the development of the military situation and the hardening of political positions. But if you think about how much suffering and destruction could have been prevented if the West, and especially the Europeans, at that time, of course, the two governments, but particularly the Europeans, had taken a constructive approach toward peace. In the 3.5 years of this war, there has not been a single attempt by the Europeans to resolve this war peacefully. The only one who tried was the Hungarian Prime Minister Orbán, and he was harshly criticized for it. He tried to get the Europeans out of this dead end, where the only outcome is a military one, meaning a military defeat for Ukraine. It hasn't had any effect. Oh, and regarding the question about Germany, yes, I have the impression that Germany is playing a very ambivalent role. We have two European countries that are very actively involved, specifically in the military sphere, France and the United Kingdom. I'd like to mention the considerations that have been underway for some time now regarding a reassurance force, which is supposed to be stationed in Ukraine in the event of a ceasefire or successful peace negotiations. Germany is somewhat ambivalent in this regard, but politically, it takes a very hard line.
Politisch vertritt es eine sehr harte Position. Ich mache das also an einem Beispiel fest.
Let me illustrate this with an example. You may recall that meeting in the Oval Office, that is, in the White House, on August 18th, where it was repeatedly demanded that before a meeting could take place, there had to be a ceasefire, which is simply not feasible. This has also been repeatedly demanded by the German side. By the way, the German way of phrasing certain things, let me put it this way, shows a mental inclination toward war. Whether this is conscious or unconscious, I cannot judge. In any case, I consider it very, very reckless. We have just seen this again in connection with the drones over Poland. We really need to try to manage things in such a way that a catastrophic military defeat for Ukraine does not occur.
Militärische Niederlage der Ukraine nicht eintritt. Daran kann niemand ein Interesse haben.
No one can have an interest in that. And we can only prevent this by achieving successful negotiations for both sides, by taking the interests of both sides into account, including our own interests, of course. Ending the war is not really a goal in itself. Rather, it is the prerequisite for creating a peace and security order in Europe, in which both Russia and Ukraine have their place, and which provides stability and security for the future to all parties involved. That is actually the crucial point. And the fact that Europeans are not working on this, I consider that not only negligent, but extraordinarily irresponsible.
You make a very interesting point with how the peace proposal by China and Brazil were dismissed, while the diplomatic efforts by Hungary was even punished. What is concerning that all of this happened now over 3.5 years, where the Europeans, we didn't even pursue any diplomacy with the Russians, not even talking to them. Now, I guess my great concern is, given that Russia considers this to be the incursion of NATO into Ukraine to be an existential threat, what would happen if Russia can't achieve its objective through diplomacy? Given its strategic objectives, what do you think Russia will do militarily? Will they strip Ukraine of all its strategic territory from Odessa to Kharkov? Or how do you see this war ending militarily if it's not through diplomacy?
Yes, you are making a very important distinction. One really has to differentiate between a political victory and a military victory or a military defeat. Politically, I have always maintained that no one can win this war. Russia, too, has had to endure a significant setback simply through Finland and Sweden joining NATO. That is certainly a major burden for Russia. So let's talk about the military aspects. I still believe that Russia wants to occupy these four regions within their former administrative borders. So not as was still possible at the beginning in Istanbul, where perhaps a referendum could have allowed the residents to decide. No, this is actually about creating a buffer zone again in these regions, also between Russia and NATO. And this would also include, if a treaty is reached, the entire Ukraine. What is not entirely clear is whether Russia will also try to take Odessa in order to establish a connection with its occupation group in Transnistria, and above all, whether it would make the strategic attempt to cut Ukraine off from access to the Black Sea. That is not entirely certain. Of course, that also depends very much on whether and when negotiations actually take place. I have the impression that the fighting will decrease somewhat in the near future. This is related to the season. The terrain in Ukraine is no longer as accessible to mechanized forces as it has been so far. But it is also because Russia itself has an interest in ending this war. This war has significantly limited Russia's geopolitical options. We can see this in the example of Azerbaijan and Armenia. Russia's influence on the South Caucasus has clearly diminished due to its involvement in the war in Ukraine. There is another factor as well. The war in the Middle East also plays a major role here.
Das ist auch der Nahostkrieg spielt hier eine große Rolle. Sollte es wieder zu militärischen Kampfhandlungen zwischen den
If there are renewed military hostilities between Iran and Israel, that is also an aspect that is not exactly pleasant for Russia. Iran is a close ally of Russia, and it is quite possible that Russia would try to exert influence toward a peaceful solution, which it currently cannot do. So Russia has a handicap here, a significant handicap. And in order to regain this geopolitical ability to act, this war really needs to come to an end. And basically, that is also the point, one of the aspects that makes me optimistic that in the end, reason will prevail.
optimistisch stimmt, dass sich letzten Endes die Vernunft doch durchsetzen wird. Das andere ist natürlich nach wie vor das große Interesse.
The other thing, of course, is Trump's ongoing strong interest in personally contributing to ending this war. But at the moment, we're in a stalemate that arose because the last rounds of negotiations in Istanbul in June didn't address the real issues at stake. On June 2nd, Russia presented a memorandum outlining its position on a ceasefire and peace negotiations with Ukraine and called on Ukraine to negotiate on that basis. This was rejected. Zelensky rejected it and said they only wanted to discuss a prisoner exchange and the abducted children.
Und über die verschleppten Kinder reden. Deshalb ist zum Beispiel auch der ständige Vorwurf an die, an
That's why, for example, the constant accusation against Russia, that Russia doesn't want to negotiate, that you can't negotiate with Russia, is not accurate. In addition, after this accusation, following the meeting in Anchorage and the meeting between the American president and the Europeans, both sides hardened their positions. Russia said, yes, we are also ready for a meeting. However, it must be carefully prepared. There must be an agenda, and there must already have been negotiations or preliminary negotiations at the highest possible level, which allow us to assess whether it actually makes sense to hold such a meeting. This roughly corresponds to the approach taken in Istanbul in 2022. Ukraine, on the other hand, said that they first want to work out the details of security guarantees. These should then be accepted by Russia. And only if Russia accepts these details will they be ready for a meeting. So we see here that this contradiction between the two positions is very difficult to resolve. And I hope that the American president will make exactly this attempt. While in the meantime, the fighting continues, more people die, and the country continues to be devastated. That is the tragedy of these two warring parties, and it is also due to the influence of the West.
I guess the danger without any negotiations is that there's only a military solution. You mentioned before the tendency to escalate by introducing new Wunderwaffe or wonder weapons to turn the war around, and this appears to be the step. Every time the proxy war seems to go the wrong way, we seem to introduce more powerful weapons. I guess it's worth here remembering Biden. He once said that introducing F-16s would be World War III, but we've gone far, far beyond this. So I wanted to ask you, therefore, about the war rhetoric and escalation between Russia and, now especially the Europeans. It has intensified a lot. To what extent do you see a risk now that Russia and Europe, if not NATO, will actually engage in a direct war?
There are two aspects that could lead to an escalation, both in the past and in the future. One aspect originates from Ukraine. Since Ukraine is very weakened on the military front, and maintaining its defense is practically no longer possible. Only delaying actions are essentially taking place there. For this reason, Ukraine has long been trying to escalate in other areas and thus draw NATO into this war. For example, through attacks on the nuclear strategic early warning system, attacks on Russia's nuclear strategic bomber fleet, or even attacks on nuclear power plants. These are attempts to elevate this war to another level, specifically to the level between the U.S. and Russia, and thus to expand this war. The other aspect concerns the intentions, particularly those coming from the Europeans. It is repeatedly said that we must enable Ukraine to use weapons effectively deep inside Russia, in other words, to give it a strategic perspective. The key term here is the German Taurus system. And that would essentially mean that the Europeans would be taking the step from indirect involvement in this war to direct involvement. However, I believe the Europeans are very much aware that without the support of the United States, this would be an undertaking that would lead to an expanded European war and the destruction of this continent.
und zu einer Zerstörung dieses Kontinents. Ich hoffe, dass Sie sich jedenfalls darüber im Klaren sind.
I hope you are at least aware of that. That is why I am watching these efforts by the so-called Coalition of the Willing with great concern, as they keep trying to get a foot in the door, so to speak, whether in connection with a peace treaty or a ceasefire, fully aware that Russia would never accept the deployment of troops from NATO countries in Ukraine. That is precisely the approach Russia has pursued from the very beginning. Ukraine, as its constitution stipulates, is supposed to be a neutral, non-aligned state without nuclear weapons. No foreign troops are to be stationed on Ukrainian territory. Those are essentially the key points.
Das sind die Kernpunkte eigentlich. Also was man erreichen will, ist eben diese.
So, what is being aimed for is precisely this large buffer zone between NATO and Russia, so that escalation does not occur due to technical failure or human error, which would then be politically uncontrollable. This situation was similar recently in connection with the drones over Poland. In that case, the response was not what it should be in a crisis situation. Seeking contact, trying to clarify the situation, establishing facts, but rather as a kind of Pavlovian reflex, it was immediately declared to be a provocation or even an attack. In this context, I also want to point out another issue, the risk of being drawn into this war.
In diesen Krieg hineingezogen zu werden, jetzt auch im Zusammenhang mit dieser Drohnengeschichte hat.
Now, also in connection with this drone incident, the Ukrainian president has once again said that preventive measures must be taken to prevent something like this from happening. And the proposal that came up at the beginning of the war, to establish a no-fly zone over western Ukraine, has resurfaced. A no-fly zone would mean a direct conflict between NATO, or the countries establishing this no-fly zone, and Russia. One must be clear about that. This has all been discussed before, but it keeps coming up. And the other question is, how could it happen that Europeans, so to speak, stumble or slide into this war with a situation developing that can no longer be controlled?
Die dann nicht mehr beherrschbar ist. Da gibt es interessanterweise ein Interview.
Interestingly, there is an interview with former Polish President Duda from September 3rd, in which he explains this incident that occurred in November 2022, where a missile struck Polish territory and I believe killed two people. That was a Ukrainian missile. But he explained that the Ukrainian president tried to pressure him into declaring that it was a Russian missile. And he said, of course, the Ukrainians have wanted from the very beginning to draw the West into this war. And what's even more astonishing to me, he then continued, and actually that would be right. I don't remember the exact wording, but actually that would be the case.
Nicht mehr im Kopf, aber eigentlich wäre es auch das. Tatsächlich ist das natürlich so, dass nur eine.
In fact, it is true that only an expansion of the war to all of Europe would prevent Ukraine's isolated military defeat. But in the end, it would lead to the destruction of the entire European continent. Politicians need to be clear about this, even when their narratives claim that Russia will always remain our enemy or that Russia can be defeated. No, that is not possible. The only solution that would save Ukraine and prevent us from being drawn into this vortex is to enter into peace negotiations that serve the interests of both sides, but are also compatible with European interests.
If I may just have one final follow-up question, is how do you explain what has happened to Europe? Because traditionally, it was the United States which tended to be more hawkish. For example, back in 2008, they were the one pushing, we have to expand NATO, while on the European side, they were pushing back. You had Angela Merkel back then arguing that this would be interpreted by Russia as a declaration of war. But now we see the roles almost switched. And in Europe, we've become very militaristic and not even wanting to do diplomacy. I'm not sure if you made up any thoughts how we ended up in this position.
Es gibt natürlich keine eindimensionale Erklärung dafür.
Of course, there is no one-dimensional explanation for this. It's a phenomenon to me as well. But from my perspective, it's like this. From the very beginning, we started out with a completely false premise, namely that this war could somehow be ended by a Ukrainian victory. an illusion, a fiction from the start. And basically, with our argumentation, I recall many statements from so-called experts who repeatedly said, and this is still partly being said today, that Ukraine is very strong, it is resilient, and Russian losses are high, and the Russian industry is on the verge of collapse, and so on. This narrative that we wanted to maintain for 3.5 years should have ended at the latest with Trump taking office. We should have sought to join forces with Trump and supported him in his peace efforts, but we didn't do that. That means what we are doing right now is continuing to put up obstacles, even for our closest ally, the United States, in the effort to end this war.
In dem Bemühen, diesen Krieg zu beenden, hat auch damit zu tun, dass wir nicht zugeben.
It also has to do with the fact that we cannot admit that we have contributed to this war, lasting for over 3 years, that we have even fueled this war by providing such massive financial support to Ukraine, by supporting them militarily, by weakening our own defense capabilities in order to support Ukraine, and finally, by failing or being unable to make even a single attempt to achieve a peaceful solution through peace negotiations. This is that persistence. I was right, but in the end, this very attitude will come back to haunt us. And primarily, it will be bitter for Ukraine itself, but ultimately for us as well. Because if Ukraine loses this war militarily, we will also lose this war militarily. It may be an indirect involvement, but without our involvement, this war would have ended long ago.
Längst zu Ende. Das muss man, ohne diese Unterstützung wäre dieser Krieg längst beendet.
Also, without this support, this war would have ended long ago. So one can only hope, in the end, that Trump prevails. And my impression is indeed that he is also trying to normalize relations with Russia again. That is a very important point. This meeting in Engels made that very clear. There are several signals pointing in that direction. The whole environment, the entire course of how this meeting went. But it is also about actually bringing about normalization. And specifically through political means, improving economic relations, and above all, restoring military stability, which has largely been lost in recent years between these two nuclear strategic superpowers. Through arms control negotiations, which are imminent, on nuclear strategic weapon systems. At the latest, these must be continued by February 5th of next year. And I think both sides have a strong interest in this. But it is also, let me add this in conclusion, about the question of what position we will take in a future geopolitical world order. Up to now, we have described this new world order as one of rival great powers, Russia, China, the United States. Now something new is emerging, a multipolar world. And as Europeans, we also have to consider where our place is. We Europeans have lost so much influence in the arithmetic of geopolitical power because of this war, and will continue to lose more, simply due to the economic disadvantages that this war has brought us. That we must try to re-establish a close alliance with the United States, and then, through a peaceful end to this war, build a new order of peace and security in Europe.
Yeah, I've had that similar concern myself that the Europeans' inability to find a place in the multipolar world is part of the reason for the panic and lack of political imagination. Yeah, so, absolutely. Well, General Harald Kujat, thank you so much for your insights. This is very dangerous times indeed. So, thanks again.
Keep our fingers crossed.